All right, so last question before we start. Ready? Round robin, sweet potatoes or regular potatoes? Ryan, go.
Sweet potatoes are pretty awesome, but if I had to lose regular potatoes forever, if you asked me just one, I'd probably pick potatoes.
Jay?
Regular. All day long, no sweet potatoes. Regular is
Ted?
Sweet potatoes.
All right, at least one of you is sane. I'm with you, Ted, on that one. I love sweet potatoes. All right, Ryan, you ready to go?
Let's do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is with deepest pride and greatest pleasure that we welcome your patch to Drupal. And now we invite you to sit back and relax while the Drupal Association proudly presents your contribution.
Simple test, simple pest, put my patches to the test. What? This is the Drupal Easy Podcast, and I am your host for today, Ryan Price. This is episode 161, recorded on August 17th, 2015. Mr. Mike Anello, do you feel particularly European today?
I do not. I'm back in the land of, hot dogs, apple pie, Donald Trump, baseball, and sweet potatoes.
And freedom fries.
Freedom fries. Yes. Good to be back. Well, it's good to be back
Indeed.
home. Not I could leave the weather.
Indeed.
Is
Well,
there a worse place in the United States in August than Florida?
no.
I'm going to say Southern Alabama, Louisiana.
I guess if there's no breeze, yeah.
Pretty nasty
That's pretty
there.
rough up
Just
there
the
too.
humidity, the swamp.
Yeah, I don't know where you are, but it's pretty darn humid around here too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, just having grown up in Florida, then when I was on tour with this, it's like a touring marching band, it's called the Drum and Bugle Corps. The worst days that we had were a couple of days in Alabama where we basically couldn't go outside in, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then in Texas, they actually like forced us to take a siesta because it was like 108 degrees outside. So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah. So yeah, you are back in the States. I think this is the first time we've recorded since you returned. So welcome home.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hopefully, the statuary treated you well. I got a
Yeah.
lot of comments about the statues.
No, it was a great trip. It was good to see all of our friends and family over there. Little change of scenery for a
Did
while.
you get to do any Drupaling while you were there?
No, I did not. Other than like my normal, work stuff, I didn't. I don't think I saw anybody. I normally try and get over to the office of it's
Crimson?
now, yeah, now Wonderkraut.
As a part of Wonderkraut? Okay.
And I just, I communicated with Joe Wouters, who's kind of the guy I know the best over there, and we had all kinds of plans to get together and for me to come by, and it just never happened. So apparently 2 months is not long enough. Although I am headed back there. I'm going to DrupalCon Barcelona, and then I'm going to head back to Belgium for another week or so after that. So maybe I can make it happen then.
Well, that's not too far away. When is DrupalCon taking place?
End of September. So I think in about a month I'll be heading over.
Very good. And we also have Mr. Ted Bowman, our roving reporter from lands far and near.
Do we have him? Because I don't hear him.
Oh, is he not there now?
He bailed on us.
I'm here now. I'm here now. I figured
He
Mike
was
was gonna.
roving.
I figured Mike was gonna go on for a bit, so I muted myself.
Well, that's a wise assumption, Mr. Ted.
Yep, here up in the slightly cooler but not super cool northeast. It's getting up to high 80s today.
Is like your like fun afternoon out? Is that like you walk to a waterfall and just kind of stand underneath it like a Irish Spring commercial?
You guys are keeping me from my waterfalls right now.
All right.
Yes, that's where I would be.
All right. Well, picks or it doesn't happen.
All right. All righty.
And our special guest of the day is actually keeping it in the Florida family. He is joining us from South Florida. It is Jay Epstein.
Hey guys.
And Jay, if anyone has ever been to a Florida Drupal camp, or I'm going to go ahead and assume that you've been up to the Atlanta ones a couple of times as well, people in the Southeast, I think, have probably heard of you. You've been doing Drupal for quite a while. Like, how long, and do you want to give us, like, your Drupal origin story?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I actually just hit my fifth year in Drupal 3 months ago. So, been around a while. Like you said, you know, I've spoken at the Florida camp quite a number of times, the South Florida camp a couple of times, Atlanta, New Orleans, Austin, Texas. So, a little bit of traveling, a bunch of presenting, and just having fun.
Cool. And, I mean, do you have an official role right now? Like, are you working for somebody, or are you just on your own?
Well, it's a combination. I'm actually on my own, but I also do all of the Drupal builds for a company named TrackTech Partners. They're based up in Boston, and I've been with them, I guess, about 3.5 years out of the 5 total that I'm around.
Those regular, longstanding clients are definitely a great relationship to have if you're a freelancer, I got to say.
They're great. I got lucky finding them, or if they found me, I'm not really sure what the direction was, but it came at a good time, and they actually let me grow a little bit, learn a lot, experiment a lot. So I'm grateful. They're great guys. They really are.
So Jay, I remember way back, I don't know if it's right when you first got started with Drupal, but for a while you were, you worked with Drupal Gardens a lot when that first launched. Is that right? Is that how you got into Drupal?
Actually, no. Well, here's the real story. I was an IT director for almost 14 years, and towards the tail end of me working there, they came to me and they said, "Hey, we heard about this thing called a CMS. We don't have one. We need a brand new website. So you need to go make us one, and you got to do it within 2 weeks." So I said, okay. So not having much of a clue, I started researching. I looked at Dreamweaver with a Microsoft backend. I looked at .NET Nuke. I looked at Cold Fusion. And I thought Cold Fusion at that point was the best. So around the same time, we had some family come in from Silicon Valley. And my sister-in-law's boyfriend was actually a pretty heavy-duty guy over at Google as far as consulting and supercomputer type of guy. So we got to, having a couple of beers and talking about, the geek side. And I told him what I was doing. And he said, "Hey, you got to look at Drupal. It's the best thing. Little learning curve, but if you do it, you're going to be happy about it." So I jumped in and I built that site within 2 weeks. It was a disaster, crash and burn, but I was actually able to put something up that had a little bit of functionality. So that was my first dive into Drupal, and I've never really looked back since. I've just gotten really jazzed on it, fell in love with it, and here I am 5 years later.
So how long were you at that job after you learned Drupal? Like, did you consciously make the switch from a full-time job to a Drupal consultant?
Absolutely. It took about, 90 days. And I took a look in the mirror and I said, okay, just shy of 14 years of doing stuff I really don't love. And now I think I found what I want to be when I grow up. So if I can leave this IT director, security blanket type of thing, I can go into something that I can grow with and do good stuff and, hopefully for many years to come. So it was literally within 90 days that I quit that job and opened up my own little LLC, and here I am.
So tell us a little bit about what you do with TrackTech. Are there particular, by senior developer, are you doing custom module development or site building or theming or a little bit of everything?
Well, actually, I have basically two hats. Hat number one is I'm a data architect. So I'm the guy they call in when they're working, pitching a client or past the pitch and they've got the sale and they're starting to figure out, what's the data, where's it coming from. So I'm the guy they bring in and they say, okay, here's our sources or source of data. How do you want to work with this to get it into Drupal? So that's piece one. Piece two, once we establish that part, then I'm actually the site builder. I don't touch any front end. And actually, as I think a couple of you guys might already know, but in the relativity data model, there is no custom code whatsoever. Actually, none of the sites that I've launched ever had it. So it's basically I wear two hats. I'm a data architect, and then I'm a site builder.
Yeah, so this is we've known each other for a while, and I mean, you've known Ryan and Ted as well, and we've talked about having you on for a while. And I guess the reason is because I feel like we haven't done like a pure Drupal podcast in a while. So this, for those listeners who, you know, are tired of hearing about everything around Drupal, you know, this podcast is basically for you because we're talking Drupal site building today. But there's a lot of different ways to build a Drupal site. There's a lot of different ways to architect a Drupal site. And some people have kind of their favorite ways of doing it. Maybe that involves their favorite set of modules. You know, I've talked to people who, right or wrong, when they build a Drupal site, everything is a page. Everything is a content type of page, because that just keeps the information architecture super simple. And if you don't need anything any more complicated, well, maybe that works. I know other people who build sites almost exclusively using panels and fieldable panel panes. You know, very, very few nodes. Your method for building a Drupal site, which you've honed, and you mentioned earlier about the fact that you speak at a lot of different camps, you know, for the past, what, maybe 2 years, you've been giving a variation of the same talk at most of those camps around this data model that you've developed.
Correct. What I try and do is that each time I'm presenting a different piece of it, I'll pick a specific part. For example, at one camp, I'll come up with relativity data model, the horizontal UI, something like that. So it's still the same, you know, the same data model, but since there's different pieces to it that actually do affect different types of users, you know, based on the time, based on how they're in, what they can do, stuff like that, I'll actually break it up into little, you know, kind of bite-sized chunks. UI, backend, you know, the entity side of things, specifically the view side of things. So it just kind of keeps the same concept fresh for different target audiences that have the interest for it.
So let me ask you, I mean, for people who don't know what the relativity data model is, and I, you know, that's going to be the majority of the people listening, kind of give us a bird's eye view of what, you know, your take on architecting, you know, a Drupal site looks like.
Okay. Well, just before I give you the straight heads up answer, let me tell you why, you know, before I even get into that. So let's call it my first year and a half, you know, where you're going through the standard take it on the chin pain of learning Drupal, content types, taxonomy, views, theme, you know, all of those Drupal-y words. When I kind of got through it and I launched a couple of sites, you know, on the professional level, I realized something that was common to all Drupal sites, and they were all basically built the same identical way. Some may have been bigger, some may have been smaller, some may have been more heavy on the front end, but the end result was still, okay, we got some content types, we got some fields, we got some views, we have these big taxonomies, and there's our Drupal site. So it led me to believe that, all right, well, wait a minute, if everyone is doing the same identical steps and putting out Drupal sites that same way, there's no possible way that anyone can actually say that these solutions are unique at any level. They're all the same building blocks, the same nuts and bolts, but they still work the same identical way. They look the same way. They act the same way. And that's where the beginning part of relativity kind of came into play, because I wanted to try and be a type of developer that had a much more simplistic view of something that could become very complex, instead of kind of like the norm or the target approach of, okay, let's bang some custom code in, you know, let's go to that level to make it sing and dance the way we think that it should. Because I personally got bit quite a number of times inheriting sites that were, you know, driven very heavily on custom code, and then I was tasked with, okay, figure it out, fix what's broken, and then make it better when you're done. And it's a no-win situation. I tried it, and I just pretty much gave up each and every time. So anyway, so now the bird's eye view of what relativity is. So here's the deal. To start off with, what it really does is it explains and teaches even a beginning site builder, basically with, you know, 4 or 5 months under their belt, it explains the concept of understanding how to be a data architect before you touch Drupal. So you need to understand what the data architecture is. What is it that you're storing? What is it that you're presenting? What are you giving over to the themers for display? And once you have a much better understanding of that, then you spin up your Drupal site. And then from your documentation, that's where you actually start building your site. Instead of what I think most people do is they fire up Drupal and they start playing right from there. I document first, you know, very heavily, make sure it looks good on paper, and then I transpose that directly into the Drupal site. So that's the beginning piece of it. Piece number two, which is, it sounds small, but it's actually pretty huge, is that there is never any custom code whatsoever. Piece number three, which complements point number two, is that it basically runs on standard contributed modules that have been around for quite some time, such as Entity API, Entity Reference, Views, CTools, all the stuff that all of us put in sites anyway, with one additional one called Field Groups, which I know is a favorite of yours, Mike. Above and beyond that, it's really the matter of taking the concept of a database join and putting that into the Drupal UI. So as an example, I have one node that has many related nodes attached to it. So instead of using taxonomy, the relationships are actually built in the Drupal UI of the first node. So when we go to that first node, we can see all related nodes on the same page.
So you are, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not a big fan of using any entity types other than nodes.
That's correct.
Right, so no taxonomy.
Correct.
So let's talk about that, because I know you have strong feelings on that subject.
Okay. I do. The way I view Drupal, this is also kind of going back to my beginning days, is, you know, Drupal is a CMS, content management system. That tells me that out of the box, its number one function, what I feel it does best, is render nodes. And it does a great job of that. Views is also designed to really go after those nodes and display stuff. So what Drupal really is, and why it was put on the face of the earth, is the management of nodes. So to go out and extend beyond, you know, past that concept, I feel what that really does is, A, it opens you up to have to load more modules to complete your data model. It also complicates the return of data, meaning views. You know, the more things that are in the middle of those queries as far as modules go and things like that, all it's going to do, it's going to slow things down for you. So if you stay as close to you, as close as you possibly can to Drupal core, which in my eyes is nodes, what it does is you could really spin up a very, very complex, well, you can spin up a very complex data model that can handle extremely complex relationships, basically with about 12 modules total, and it will scale and continuously scale without any complications. There's no version dependencies on anything because there's no custom code. So that's my bird's eye view of the node side of what Relativity is doing.
So give us an example. Like, when, you know, what's a site you've built recently that has, that kind of uses this data model, and how did you, you know, we don't have to talk about the entire thing, but, you know, maybe just a couple of these relationships that you're talking about.
Okay. I guess the best one, which is probably going to be the most complex data returns, would be F1Boston.com. That's basically a series of really, really big go-kart tracks up in Boston. You know, known all over the world, all the pro race drivers, you know, go there and, you know, that kind of stuff. Actually, they also race there too. So they came to us. They were running an old Cold Fusion site, and they said, "Hey, you know, we heard about your data model. We think it's going to do what we're looking to do, but we need to be able to generate inside of Drupal real-time statistics as far as the races that are happening. Now, this could be happening on one of, I guess, six tracks between indoors and outdoors. It's also split across a league division and class type of thing. So you have adults, summer league with different classes below it, same thing for the juniors. And they want to be able to see top three statistics and then detailed statistics of each and every driver based on the rounds that they run and also within the seasons that they run. And they want to be able to see one historical season behind what they're currently looking at." So when I looked at this, you know, I originally started saying, it kind of sounds like OG, where each one of these things becomes a group, and then there's multiple groups below that. But I took a look at the size and complexity and overhead of OG, and I was like, nah, we're not going to go there. So then I started looking at other alternatives, which is the group module. I looked, you know, there was just no clear way to really get this done. So I said, you know what, let's go back to Relativity, and let's say, okay, we have a league. One league has many divisions. One division has many classes. It's a good old-fashioned database join, you know, one to many. So within those results, then we can actually say, okay, we have a new node type called a race result. Well, actually a race and then a race result. So with that said, then each league division and class can have many races and also many race results. And that's where the beginning of all these aggregated views came from. So when you look at the site, if you have to go up to the site, f1boston.com, over on the left-hand menu, you'll actually see there's a link for league standings. And that, if you go there, you'll actually get an idea of how these things are, how it's broken down by different leagues, divisions, and classes, and all of the stats that are happening within those things.
Now, just to play devil's advocate, I mean, if you, you know, building something like that where, and just to follow along with this model that you're talking about, if each, you know, league has divisions, is that right?
Yes,
and
correct.
And each division has multiple classes?
Right, league, division, class, correct.
Okay, so, but wouldn't it make sense that the same class exists in more than one division?
Most of it, actually, no, because things are basically broken down by either you're an adult or you're a kid, or a junior, I should say, excuse me. So the adults have leagues. As an example, they have a winter league, they have a fall league, and then they have a spring league. But within each one of those leagues, they have multiple divisions. Heavyweight drivers, lightweight drivers, middleweight drivers. Within those weight classes, then they have, you know, one more layer below that as far as the classes go. So at any one point in time, each class is actually specific to itself, and they never will share amongst another division or league.
All right, so let me turn to Ted and Ryan real quick. Just based on you know, what Jay described, I mean, for me, I would immediately look towards something like fuel collection, like get some other entity involved. How do you guys approach building sites, and, you know, with this type of information architecture? Do you guys have like a go-to method that you guys use?
I mean, I think I would use something similar. And Jay, in your case with the races, like an individual race, does that have an entity reference to? Does that have an entity reference pointing to some sort of parent?
It does. It points up. Well, you have the race, which is how you can actually register for different upcoming races. Let's call it that. These are races in the future. I want to register my child for these six races. And then the after, you know, the after side of this, well, I really should have kind of elaborated on this, that this, the data that's actually coming into Drupal is really being brought in by feeds from their race management systems. So all of the stats are actually computed down to the hundredth, you know, of a second, you know, based on the racer's performance. These stats are actually then loaded up onto a CSV file, you know, through the track management system. And then I go out with feeds and I pick these things up on a regular basis, and the system will actually automatically update those stats as they come through. So I should have told you about that before, but that's another big piece of this. So the migration of a race result basically is a standalone. So when those things come in, views, you know, that's where it's actually doing an up relationship. So the race result, to answer your question, Ted, points up to, well, the data that comes in points up to, you know, up to the race result.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the major difference between, I don't know, the model that I would use usually, and I probably don't have it as well documented as Jay does, which I think is part of like the real advantage here, is having it really well documented, is that I think I would probably more often have like a child point up to its parent, where in the model that you're talking about, it seems like most, like the big league or something would have all of its divisions within the same UI. Like it would have any reference pointing down.
You're correct. Most of the relationships that are based in the UI are pointing down. So this parent node has this child node. This child node has two children of its own, that type of thing.
Yeah.
However, when things are coming in from an external source, like in this case, you know, from that CSV feed, that's where it's actually doing an entity reference up to its parent entity, which would have been the actual race result.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would do something similar, except in most cases I would have like a add, like if you're looking at a league or something, you have to add a race or something like that, add a division, and that would point up to the parent.
Let me give you one more quick example, because it's the same identical concept, but it's actually quite a bit less complicated, but I think it might be easier to illustrate for people listening. For Time Warner Business Class, one of their ISP sites that they own called Navisite, we just did a brand new re-architecture build on their resource center. So here's an example. If we create a content type called resource center item, and then we have another node type called resource center item type, that resource center item type is going to take the place of taxonomy because it becomes nothing more than a drop-down selection on the resource item. So they have, you know, case studies, white papers, quick tips, market insights, solution briefs, service briefs. I think it's a total of 12 individual types of assets. However, they are all entered into the system as a resource center item. And then when each one is created, they flip the flag on, well, what kind of resource center item type is this? And based on what they select, conditional fields will either hide or show the appropriate fields they need for that type of content. So there's a one-to-many across 12 levels where that's a really super, you know, great way to illustrate it. And actually, it really works very quickly because Views at any one point in time is running one query to the current node that it's on. So all related nodes are rendered through, you know, a block view from that same page.
But what about, like, in this case, you know, if I was pointing up to a parent and you do a node, so in your case, if you have a bunch of children directly on the node, if you do a whenever the system does a node load, is it going to have to load those children? I forget how that works. Or is it just, I think it actually is just loading the actual ID and not.
Yeah, that. I think by default it just loads the reference.
Out of the box Drupal, normally when you set up an entity, you know, a down entity reference, it's going to give you the label, the title of the entity that you just related to. However, I shut all of that down. That's one thing I don't let Drupal render for me. That's all done by blocks. So anything that's related to the current node or the current page hit, all I need to do is read that, you know, through a contextual filter for the current node ID, and all of those children are then built out with individual block displays.
What I found interesting when I was reading the article, I mean, I guess less interesting than, I mean, I do found, like, the system interesting. But what I think is more interesting is having it laid out. Because I feel like in Drupal, there's a lot of documentation for individual modules. But obviously, whenever we're building Drupal sites, we're using them in, you know, relation to each other. And I feel like there's not as much sort of good documentation. There's a lot of good documentation on individual modules like entity reference or something like that, or tutorials, but not like how to use it in a larger and like opinionated way, which I think everybody, when they get a system that works for them, it starts to be opinionated, which I don't think is a bad thing. But I think a lot of documentation or tutorials try to be less opinionated as far as, like, okay, generally this is how you can use entity reference, where you're really laying out like a framework for a larger way to build sites. But I think Drupal, like, or at least maybe I just haven't found it. I don't think a lot of good documentation exists like that. Like, okay, this is how I make sites. And it's not just like, these are the modules I use. It's, you know, here's a model that, here's my opinion about a good way to relate content to each other.
I appreciate you noticing that. And that's really what I had set out to do. Now, you know, what's up on my website, you know, as far as the relativity overview, that's a work in progress. It's been going on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I try and update it as time allows, which, you know, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not. So, you know, there's quite a bit left to go. However, I do want to say one thing. Whatever the listeners may read on my website, you know, as far as they can go, which I believe is page 8 or 9 or something like that. We've actually had three of our local Broward Drupal user group members take the data model into Drupal 8. So, and it worked like a charm, just like it did in Drupal 7. So it is not a version specific thing. So just one more thing to kind of look at. It's really, this is not specifically for 7. It could be 7, 8, or Drupal 26, as long as the entity API is still there, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, so that's a good segue for kind of my next big question here is, what module? We've talked about kind of the methodology. Well, good, Ryan.
Mike, could I just, before we move on?
Yeah,
sure.
I think the main thing, like, for people that maybe aren't visualizing it yet, for me, the reason why J is you know, system makes sense is that if you don't know the Drupal interface, you know, backwards and forwards, and you haven't been using it for 3 years and built all kinds of sites with it, there's a lot of different places where you can go and edit something, right? Do I need to go to taxonomy to edit this? Do I need to go to blocks to edit this? Do I need to go to content types and click manage? You know, like, do I just, when I want to add something new, do I add a node? Do I add, you know, a user? What do I add, right? So it just takes away a lot of those questions. It's like if the Drupal user interface has some bad anti-patterns in it, then this is a way of saying, like, well, let's just forget that, you know, 90% of those anti-patterns exist by just only dealing with nodes wherever possible. And everything's in entity reference, and all entity reference point down by default. I think it's just trying to say, like, you know, let's chop the most confusing 80% out of Drupal, which is all of the different ways you could represent something, and just deal with some really simple basic stuff. And then it just becomes, how do I want to organize it? How do I want to display it? You know, how do I want to make it search engine friendly, as opposed to all of the myriad ways that you could possibly organize things?
Well, I think Jay's arguing, though, and Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, is that yes, you are simplifying the building blocks, or you're using fewer building blocks, but I mean, you're definitely of the opinion that it's a superior way to build sites as well.
I absolutely, yes. And the reason I say that is because I actually went through 3 straight years of building Drupal sites, just like everyone else does, all the same methodologies, all the same complexities. And when I compared both side by side, you know, past that third year, I realized that, hey, wait a minute. If I can build the University of Colorado's data model, you know, using relativity, and the data model before the themers got a hold of it was 3 meg, including the data that was in the site, that led me to believe that, all right, wait a minute, I am now, without question, starting off with a very, very tiny footprint that, number one, can scale up as far as they needed to scale up, support anything, you know, obviously at the university level, which is a very, very deep architecture, you know, course catalogs, instructors, schedules, rooms, buildings, books, you know, video, all this kind of stuff. So is it necessarily superior across the board for everyone that may want to get involved? That's an unknown. I found it to be superior for me specifically. But I can tell you that I've built many different types of site, reference libraries, like I said, universities, travel and hospitality sites, specifically, you know, cruise line. We've done things all the way down to, you know, brochure sites, and also, which I mentioned before, F1, which is literally nothing more than a whole bunch of aggregated complex views also built off this model. So it is not specific to any one type of site building. It's really out there as a concept for people to use, build upon, maybe change on their own to make, you know, it'll work for them. But I found it to just work across everything personally.
So let's talk about some of the modules that you leverage to get this done.
Okay. Really simple. So number one, CTools, you got to have it. It's just the way it is. Views, you got to have it. It's just the way it is. Token, one of those guys you got to have. Path Auto, one of those guys you got to have. So right there, everyone's got to put those in. So really, here's where relativity kicks in. It's basically going to be field group, entity API, entity reference, entity connect, entity reference view widget, and conditional fields. That's all there is.
So out of that list, there's really only, I'd go so far as to say there's only four modules that you mentioned that are, I don't want to say normally not used, but the other, what, 8 that you mentioned or whatever, however many it was?
Correct.
Those are modules you find on most Drupal sites.
Yeah, absolutely.
CTools, views, all that. So let's focus on the four that you may or may not find on most sites, which are field group, entity auto connect,
entity connect,
entity connect, the views widget,
entity reference view widget,
and what was the fourth? Did I say field group?
There you go. I think that's the one you missed. Yep, correct.
And field group. So let's talk about, well, Field Group is I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's probably the easiest one to grok, because that's what you're using to really organize the node at edit pages. Is that correct?
That's correct. Absolutely.
Oh, you guys missed conditional fields.
Oh, thank you. I said field group twice, I think. Okay, conditional fields.
Correct.
All right. So as far as field group, its main purpose in this model is to better organize your node at edit page. And I'm guessing, you know, from what I know about the model, mainly because there's so many references and that page can get a bit unwieldy.
Well, here's the real reason that I went down this direction is that everything that I saw in my earlier years of Drupal development, and also even currently right now, by default, Drupal looks to put things out vertically. Everything is always stacked one on top of the other, and that is basically Drupal site-wide. But most of all, it's that way in the Node UI. However, we are designed as humans to read left to right. So I have two options. Either I go to the theme or I say, hey, do me a favor, theme the whole Node UI of Drupal, or I go to this very small, you know, module that's been around for many, many years, been tested and true. It's a workhorse, and I let that help me assemble that horizontal concept of the Node UI.
In a way that makes sense for not necessarily you, the architect, but more importantly, the content administrator.
This has nothing to do with me. This is all completely custom built for whatever the group, whatever the audience is of who's, well, the people that are going to enter the content in or edit the content on a daily basis. So the workflow is designed around a thing called their user thought process. And what that really means is if their supervisor said to them, hey, do me a favor, go add this node. So they're going to go through a mental procedure and say, okay, I need to go here, I need to edit this, I need to click this. They're already kind of thinking through that flow. So the horizontal UI is always custom built around that specific workflow that they're thinking about.
Okay, when you say horizontal, you're talking about like using the field group's ability to have different field groups displayed in different ways. So
correct.
Are you using something called tabs or what is it?
Right, well, everything begins with a div, an outer div, and that allows me to display what's going to sit below it. That's the only reason I'm using the div. So below that, we would get a horizontal tab group, which is basically nothing more than a wrapper that's going to contain multiple horizontal tabs. Within each horizontal tab is where the fields would actually slide up. So as far as building the UI, it is a pretty big hierarchy or tree, if you will. But when you get to the end and you actually go and you look at the node add or node edit, everything just kind of lays really, really nice. It's all horizontal, and there's not much vertical scrolling on the page whatsoever.
So one thing I think that's really important that this brings up is I feel like what's left off a lot of Drupal site builds is, you know, as a Drupal site builder, it's your responsibility to make a good admin interface for your client. And Drupal gives you a lot of flexibility to do that, but I feel like a lot of people, that's where they sort of leave off. Like maybe they build a good site architecture as far as relating content via references, but they don't spend enough time, at least to the sites that I've seen, either inherited or, you know, consulting with people who are like, well, I don't know how to use my site. I don't know where to go. It's like the site builder obviously didn't put a lot of thought into, okay, Drupal's admin interface is overwhelming. And I think it comes down to the sites that I've seen, it often comes down to two things, like giving the person too many permissions, like so they see too many options, and then also not either designing, you know, links appropriately or edit screens for nodes or other UIs, just making them sort of not crafting them, making them sort of unwieldy.
I agree. And also there's one more level to that, to what you were just mentioning. The old-fashioned, let's go to the content list and find the nodes that we want to deal with, you know, which is something that really, really plagues any end user or content editor, whatever. The admin menu bar is never turned on for anyone except an admin. So there is no multiple places to go, you know, to what you just mentioned. What I do is I use the dashboard of Drupal, which I really haven't seen many site builders or devs take advantage of what that thing can do. I exploit it because it's a very, very powerful way just using a very simple rule. If a user logs in of a specific role, they're going to go to the dashboard and see specific management views that are built custom based on what their permissions allow and what they're capable of doing inside the system. So if they want to add a node, then one of those management views will actually have a link that says node add. If they're not allowed to do that, they won't be able to see it. So the management UI is actually tailored to the person that's logged in, and then the rest of the site kind of follows through from that dashboard, from that initial dashboard hit.
All right, so let's move on to what module do you want to talk about next?
Okay, so, Entity Connect.
Sure.
Let's go with that one. Entity Connect gives me a nice, cool little UI on an autocomplete widget from Drupal that will allow me to add my child node from the node that I started. So if I'm on a Resource Center item and I want to add a white paper on that standard Drupal autocomplete field, I'm going to see a little green check or a little yellow pencil. If I want to add a new node that does not yet exist, I would add the green icon, and that will open up a new add page for the for this new type. And when I save that node, it's going to take me back to the parent node automatically and fill in the autocomplete. And the icon for the pencil, if something does already exist, it would let me edit that child node, complete my edit, and then come back to the parent automatically. It's a very simple module.
And the slick thing about it is when you hit to add a new reference node or edit an existing one, it takes you away from your parent node, but then when it returns you to the exact same state.
Correct.
So I know that there's a bunch of other modules that do similar functionality.
Example, inline entity form, right?
Yeah, that's one of them. So why did you decide on this one?
When I first looked at inline entity form, I know that was really more of a commerce type of concept. And when I looked at the way the UI was laid out, I was like, it could be too complex. I just didn't like the way it looked. When I stumbled, actually, it was just a lucky thing that I found Entity Connect. I was like, wait a minute, that really holds true to everything that I'm trying to do, which is make the whole back end of Drupal a very simple place to be, where if you need to add something that doesn't exist, you hit the green plus. If you need to edit something that's already there, you hit the yellow pencil. It just fit in a very elegant way.
So in Entity Connect, so if I'm adding a child that doesn't exist yet, and then that child has an option to have another child be added through Entity Connect, do you use that methodology, or do you just not have children that are going to also need additional children like that?
No, actually, in many cases, I do. I will build a multiple, from the parent down to a child, then the child has multiple children below it. So depending on the complexity of the site, the answer is yes, I will go down that far. However, I also evaluate the end user's ability to track how far they're going down, meaning do they understand the data architecture enough to know where they are in the flow. If the answer is that may be a shaky area, then I definitely won't go down that far. But more often than not, it's nothing more than a training type of situation based on that user thought process. I just need to show them where in the UI this piece of their user thought process is occurring, and usually they get it.
How far down the rabbit hole?
What's that?
How far down the rabbit hole?
Yeah. Jay, this would be a good time to mention also that you have a system for naming fields and content types so that you know that when you're looking at a particular field, particularly when you're editing it in views, right, that you always know that this field references this content type. You don't just name it something arbitrary. You give it a specific kind of a name.
Correct. So when I'm creating a content type, as an example, well, we'll go back to Navisite for the resource center item. That one is item, I-T-E-M, and I always try and cap these at 4 characters. And when I have an entity reference out that's describing that item, the only thing that I'll do is I'll add a T-Y at the end. So I have an item and then an item T-Y. The reason I do that is that those become the indexed values that the Drupal node is actually going to use. So when I go into views, I'm going to be looking at the index of item. And then when I'm doing related displays with views, I'm going to just go ahead and create a relationship to the item TY or item type, all right through the one contextual filter. So you're right, Ryan. But it's always capped around 4 characters on the parent node and then on an entity reference, it would actually be the 4 plus 2, which would be item type or something similar.
So do you know if entity reference, when you're adding, or entity connect, when I'm adding a child, it hasn't saved the parent, right? It like stores that form state in some sort of cache variable, then comes back to it, or do you,
that's
do you know?
That's okay. Correct. That's correct. It will create the cache state. It'll go out, create the node, and then just read the previous cache state and go right back to where you were.
And do you know if there's any problems, say, if somebody has two tabs open and they forget to come to one and they add another one? Because it would seem like if it's keeping a cache of somebody's adding a node, mm-hmm. and now they've added a child, but oh, they forgot and they came back later and now they have another tab and they're adding a parent and they're referencing a child. Does it ever get confused about, you know, which is the real parent?
I haven't seen it happen because I make this part of the training process where, you know, in one single page or in one single tab, everything that you need to do that's you know, associated to this one node is all in the one UI. So if I do see people automatically go into multiple tabs, I'll try and make that a training procedure where, hey, look, you don't even have to go there. Check this out. If you do it this way, you're going to be good to go. So I haven't been bitten by it yet.
Well, and you, Jay, have also mentioned that one of the things that can happen with this way of building sites is since everything's kind of driven by these views and blocks and things, you end up with some orphan nodes kind of scattered around the site sometimes. What are some of the ways that you've come up with to kind of like tackle some of those issues?
Well, what I found is that, you know, to what Ted was saying, let's make believe I click on my little green icon and I go to create my child node, and for whatever reason I don't save the child node back to the parent. So I save it at the child level and then I click my back button or I close the browser on the parent. So really what I did is I did create a valid child node, but it is not actually linked to the parent node. So using views bulk operation, all I need to do is go in, set up a little block view or page view, whatever, that goes out and reads all nodes that do not actually have a reference back to its parent using an up relationship on the view. And then using rules, I can then go ahead and send notifications out to sysadmins that, hey, you know, as of today, we noticed that you have three orphan nodes. Now, now because these things are all set up as Drupal autocompletes, the content editors can go back and just start typing inside that autocomplete and go and join the correct node, save the parent, and now everything's back in sync.
Yeah, so just pointing out that, you know, if somebody is going to end up trying this system out, that there are some, it's just every system has side effects, right? So that's one of the possible side effects.
Absolutely, yes.
So I'll jump in. I'm not a huge, I really like the idea of sculpting, you know, the UI to the person who's editing and making a really clear model for that and a clear relationships. But, and I guess my only caveat in Indie Connect, which really I don't think comes into effect in your case because everything's a node, is that I don't really like how Indie Connect is hard coded for certain entity types. And it doesn't give other modules the ability to work with it. So if somebody wants to say, hey, because like now it works with ECK, I didn't look back at the issue, but there, you know, it has to be hard-coded to ECK versus there's no alter hooks and there's only one other hook that it provides. And to basically say, okay, I would like to be able to, because the way that Drupal 7 works, the, you know, any system is maybe not as generic as it could be. So for another module to work with Entity Connect, you would have to actually contact the author and say, hey, I'd like to put a patch to make it work with this or that entity. And if it, you know, if enough entities did that, that this module would get really complex and really confusing. Versus something like inline entity form, there's actually a hook that you can provide. Okay, here's how my module that defines the entity should implement the ability to provide an inline entity form. Which, I mean, inline entity form does work well. There definitely are problems with working with certain entity types. But yeah, I guess if you're working with just nodes and it doesn't really, or taxonomy terms, because it it provides functionality, I think, for all the core entity types. But I just, I don't know, maybe it's, and maybe it's not that, I guess it's just something that sort of, and I almost hate to like mention problems or something that I see as a problem with another module, because obviously like somebody made this module and it obviously serves a really good purpose and it's
Ted,
serving
let's
a lot
just
of
say
people.
It out loud that this module does not support entity forms.
It does not support entity forms.
Yeah. You're just dancing around it and I'm tired of it.
It doesn't support a lot of entity types.
Especially.
Well, yeah, especially products. yeah.
All right, but Ted, listen. I agreed to let you talk about this before the podcast. Fine. You got it out of your system. Can we be done with it?
We're done with it. We're done with it.
Well, Ted, so is there, I mean, I don't know if the answer to this question was somewhere in there. Yeah. I don't think it was, but is there another Entity Connect type module that you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, I prefer inline entity form or making more of it like a parent situation where I'd build a similar interface to what Jay is talking about, except for the tabs wouldn't be part of the edit form. The tabs would be views that are tabs. And okay, I don't, in the example that he has on the website, there's, I guess it's an event website and you have the event and then venue and then time slots, sponsors, featured speakers. I would usually say have for the time slots, that would be a view showing time slots that point up to the parent and then have a link to say, add a new time slot using any reference pre-populate or is field pre-populate where you're basically in the URL, you're saying define this, the entity reference will point to this parent and don't let anybody change it. So when they click add to add a time slot, you can't say it's already defined which event that time slot's for. So then you would redirect to the parent when you save it and then it shows up in the list automatically. But you know, two of one, half dozen of the other.
There you go. All right, so let's talk about the entity views block widget. What was that one called, Jay?
The entity reference view widget.
Yeah, that one I don't think I've used. What is that one?
Well, it's the same concept as an entity reference view where you can, you know, put a little checkbox thing when you're making selections of existing nodes. However, the entity reference view widget gives you a nice CTools modal window pop-up where you can create some really complex, you know, exposed filters, better exposed filters, all that kind of goodness in this nice pop-up screen where they can select things that already exist. So I use that pretty heavily in these things where if they need to go out and grab a hold of, let's say, several nodes that already exist, maybe they're doing, you know, adding some related content, and instead of doing one at a time, which is what we've been talking about, which is the adding of them, they actually want to go out and grab seven that already exist. So that's the widget that I use to be able to do that.
So it's like a really fancy autocomplete.
It's extremely fancy in the sense that any view that you build with all of the goodness of exposed filters and contextual filters, you know, all of those things that you would build into a complex view, now they actually become the selection criteria with this nice little checkbox to the left.
Right, so a custom autocomplete.
If you've ever used the media module, the media browser it's a very, very specialized case of this kind of a window, right? I want to select from my media library. Well, there's lots of other things that the media browser does, but the library tab or the my files tab or whatever they call it, right? That it's is basic. A view that you can use to select things to put into your entity references.
It's basically a way to give them a really robust and or as complex as you need to be search functionality to search for existing entities.
True. Very true.
Does it work well with Entity Connect?
Absolutely. Well, actually, the two of them together, I don't ever use together because, you know, my concept is if the node is not there, that's where you're going to click, you know, go ahead and click on that little green icon thing. Depending on how I set what's going on inside that specific UI, I know based on those user thought processes where in the UI, they're going to need to add something that doesn't exist, and also where they're going to need to grab a hold of something that does exist. So in some cases, I may even use two entity references, one to create things that don't exist, or one to grab stuff that already does.
So if Entity Connect, but Entity Connect lets you do either, right? Like to grab stuff that exists or create a new one.
Well, I use the Entity Connect module specifically only with the Drupal autocomplete out of the box.
Okay.
So
on the Entity Connect page, it does mention Entity Referenced View widget that it says partial support. So I haven't used them together before, but
that's the reason why I kind of stayed away from it, because I said if they're saying it's partial, and I'm not a code guy, I'm not a module guy at any level. So if it's partial for them and they wrote the module, it's definitely out of my league. So I just stayed away. And that's why I keep the two separate.
Yeah, I think I used Entity Reference View widget maybe when it was first coming out, and it's definitely complex. I haven't looked at it for a while, but it's complex what it's trying to do.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
All right, so the last one, conditional fields.
Conditional fields is specifically a way for me to toggle something on or toggle off based on a drop-down selection. So, again, with the Navisite, if we're going to enter a resource item and they're going to select what kind of type that is with the drop-down field for the entity reference, based on that selection, I can then show fields or hide fields based on that criteria. That's all it's doing, showing stuff and hiding stuff.
All right, fair enough. So let's.
So could you give us a for instance with one of the examples, like?
Sure. So if I'm going to go and create a resource item and I select the case study as the type, well, a case study in their situation basically only has two fields. One would be the case study file, which is a PDF or an Excel or whatever, and the other one would be the case study image, which is, call it the icon or, you know, something like that. There's really no body field, so it's just those two fields. And then they have a thing called a solution brief that also has the same type of fields, but that's, you know, using the machine names, they're named appropriately and they're separate from one another. So if they hit the select list for a case study, it's only going to show those two fields.
This is how you get around field collections.
Exactly.
Right.
Correct.
And yeah, I mean, it's definitely a valid system if you don't need to have, you know, like seven of them. The situation I've had has basically been, you know, the example I've worked with the most was, you know, I have this event and I have seven performances of one event, and the performance has to have, you know, a ticket ID number, it has to have a date, and then it has to have an optional title, but it could also have a field that says this performance has a sign language interpreter and this performance has a, you know, a special talk back afterwards or something like that. You know, in that case, I guess I could make each performance a node, but for me, when I was doing it, you know, field collections was perfect for that because I don't really want a performance to be a whole entire node. Like I never want someone to click on the link to a performance and have it be a whole page. I only really want them to click on the performance and always go back to the event.
The other thing that I've used the conditional fields to do is just literally toggle other UI elements based on the first one. So, you know, as the example, I selected case studies. So if I select case studies, I can then surface another field. Let's call it a checkbox or, you know, a Boolean that says, do you want to add body copy? And if they select yes, then I can conditionally show, you know, text fields, things like that. So based on all of their little user thought process steps, I can either show or hide fields based as they're, you know, as they're going through what they're trying to think about what they're trying to do.
Yeah, that's cool. Just throw some extra checkboxes and radio buttons in there just for keeping the user interface clean.
Exactly. Now, a lot of people will say, you know what, I disagree because that means you're going to stack a whole bunch of fields on one node type. You know what? That's actually true. In some cases, it can get pretty big. However, even at the university level, the largest number of fields on one content type that I've ever done would be, I think it was 31, and that was more than manageable by conditional fields and anything else that we've talked about today. It was fine.
I think one thing is interesting about laying out this methodology, it brings up the point of, I've seen some sites where people will have something like they need something like Entity Connect, and then one part of the site they use Entity Connect, and another part of the site they use inline Entity Forms, another part of the site they use Entity Reference Auto Create. And it just, I think it can really be a really confusing, one, user experience for the user if you're not sort of unifying how it's done across the site, but also a really confusing developer experience, either across one site or across like multiple sites, if you know you have the same developers working on multiple sites, to not sort of realize like, okay, this is how we connect entities together, to have some sort of methodology around that. Whereas I feel like some people will have a different way to do it for every site or for every content type on the site, which gets really confusing. And then you end up having a lot more modules.
I agree.
And if anyone is curious about this system, if you go to the show notes for this podcast, which I believe I said is 161, then you can get a link to the sort of wiki on Jay's website, j-epstein.com, and check out the articles about how to use Relativity. You know, it's not really a module. It's not really like a piece of code, although there are some presentations you've given, right, Jay? Like maybe somebody could go and watch like a pre-recorded thing that's been made before.
There are some stuff. I think last year's Atlanta Camp was recorded. I think Austin was recorded. But they're actually pretty old at this point. So my website is probably going to be the best source of information.
Are you going to be anywhere coming up? Do you have any plans?
At this point, to be honest with you, no. Last year I did a bunch of traveling. This year I kind of slacked off a little bit. So hopefully next year I'll do a bunch more.
Are you planning on submitting this for Drupal Camp Atlanta in October?
I think today is the last cutoff, so I really, if I'm going to do it, I should really do it today.
All right, well, so, we'll let you go then. No.
Mike, there's one module you didn't talk about.
Which one?
The custom module.
There is no custom module.
Exactly. But that...
I fell right into that. I walked right into it like a noob.
So... You like no custom code even for like altering a form or something like that?
That's correct.
Wow. Tough rule to live by.
Ted finds that obscene, by the way. He just won't say it.
I'm sure. I've gotten a lot of dirty looks at a lot of camps, you know, when I put that out there. And they'll come up, you know, after the session, and they'll challenge me with foul language, dirty looks. And it's just, it doesn't come into play. It's just not there.
Ted.
Well, I'm going to make a confession. When I built this past Drupal Camp Florida site, I swore up and down there would be no custom code. But because we didn't realize that the Eventbrite API had a version 2 out, we thought it was still on 1. We actually went ahead and created a module and then figured out, oh boy, the version 2 had everything that we needed. So we did put a custom module in when we didn't really have to. So.
I would say I give you a pass on the no custom code because you're limiting the number of modules. I think a lot of people will be like, no custom code, so they install like tons of modules to get around no custom code. And I'm like, you're more dependent on way more code, and just because it's not custom doesn't mean it's actually going to be maintained. Mm-hmm. So I think... When I hear no custom code, but then you have, you know, hundreds of modules installed, I feel like that's where I feel like the mantra of no custom code is a problem.
I probably should come up with a better way to articulate that. You got a good point.
But I mean, your system, you're documenting and relying on like not that many modules.
Technically, it's a total of 14 that I start every Drupal site with, which includes, like Mike had said before, cTools, Views, Path Auto, Token, all of those guys. So it's a total of 14, and I really stick to that all the way through the whole architecture build.
That's commendable.
Wasn't easy to figure out, but we got the formula, and it works. Yeah.
Well, and I guess though, the one other thing to say is like a lot of systems, when you're dealing with a system like this, every time you know, every time you step outside of the sumo ring, you're doing it wrong, right?
What?
I don't know.
I probably don't know enough about sumo wrestling.
When you break the model, right? Uh-huh. When you say, oh, well, this one time I'll just use, you know, this one other module. Like, it's not to say that there are no other modules you can use, but, you know, if you go and say, well, I'm not going to use taxonomy, except for this one time I'm going to use taxonomy.
Right.
You're doing something. You're not following the process. And by not following the process, you are adding that extra complexity. And now, oh, you have all 99 of these cases where all I have to do is edit a node, except for this one time when I have to edit a taxonomy term. It makes it so that you're not actually taking advantage of all of the benefits this system gives you.
No, I don't know if I buy that.
Jay, do you actually disable the taxonomy core module?
Absolutely. Every time.
Any other core modules that you disable that are commonly not disabled?
Let me think. That's a good question. You got me on that one. Oh, well, comments. You know, I definitely turn that one off all the time. That's basically it. Comment, the, you know, the core comments and taxonomy.
I would say that to Ryan's point, it's like I feel like you learn a system really well and you learn the rules, but then you have to know when to break them. Like you shouldn't not break them. I don't think, you know, breaking it when it seems, I mean, obviously Jay's building his own sites. You can do it however you want. But I think like if you have a system, like you said, with that, I mean, for all he knows, there wasn't another version of that Eventbrite module. So you had to break the rule when it made sense to break the rule.
Right.
I mean, there was another version, but it could have been that there wasn't.
I guess the rule about taxonomy and other entity types is maybe the cardinal rule.
That's
the prime directive.
Yeah. That's big to this system for sure.
Well, Mike, you got anything else you want to add before you move on to Drupal Easy News?
No, I think we covered it well. I know that you know, it's funny because, you know, obviously I teach a lot of beginners Drupal, and I take them through all parts of Drupal core. And a lot of them here in the Central Florida area who then either watch Jay's presentation, or Jay's actually been up to our area a couple times to give, like, you know, on a Saturday to give like 6 or 7 hours on this data model. They walk out of there giving me dirty looks like, why the hell do we have to know taxonomy and all this other stuff? Jay's model's great. You suck, Mike. Go away. You know, I mean, it really is. It's a super interesting a data model, and it kind of opened my eyes to. And every now and then you see other people blog about how they build Drupal sites. And this goes back to Ted's point, which I think was right on, about we get a lot of documentation, a lot of blog posts about module X or module Y or module Z. But there's so few, you know, well-written either blog posts or presentations about an entire methodology for here's how I use these, in Jay's case, you know, would say 14 modules.
Yes.
To do something really cool. And I think those are super valuable for people to kind of see how to build Drupal sites in a more holistic manner rather than kind of, you know, surgically explaining this one module, then leaving it up to the reader to figure out, well, how does that fit into everything else that I'm doing? So super valuable stuff. I've stunned everybody with my comment. Wow. Pick up your jaws off the floor. I know. What do you say, Ryan? Should I roll right into some Drupal Easy News?
Go for it.
All right. So I just mentioned I train a lot of Drupal beginners, and I do that mainly through the Drupal Career Online program. And lo and behold, it's starting up here in the next few weeks in September. So it's called the Drupal Career Online Program. It's 12 weeks of awesome Drupal training. We do it all online in a live classroom. You get to listen to me for part of that time, you know, teach you Drupal. And plenty of exercises and plenty of project work and collaboration with your fellow students. We meet 3 times a week. Over those 12 weeks, 2 of them are classroom sessions. A third one is a lab session where students are working together on different projects. If you are interested, or if you know someone who's interested, or if you are a Drupal organization that is looking to hire some junior talent and you know where the talent is, but they don't know Drupal, well, send them our way and we can get them trained up. We teach them not only Drupal stuff, but we also teach them how to use Git, and kind of a lot of the tools that revolve around Drupal. You can always go to DrupalEasy.com/DCO for Drupal Career Online for more information, or feel free to reach out to me through Twitter or however if you'd like some more information about that. And I do want to thank buildamodule.com. They've been a great supporter of our program all along. So I want to do a better job of thanking all of our various supporters. And I'm going to start off today by mentioning buildamodule.com. And thanks to Chris and the whole team over there for being such a huge supporter of our program.
Good times. I think this is time for the three stories section of the show. And our first story is actually something that I'm going to go ahead and call breaking news, even though it was started as long ago as June 20th of 2014, because so far on the Drupal Core conversation, it only has 10 comments, and 10 comments is not that much. I guess you're actually pointing to the Drupal Watchdog article here, Mike. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. So a couple of days ago, there was an article by Mark Carver that says Drupal should use an external front-end framework, and the very first thing he does is link to an issue on Drupal.org, which, as I said, only has 10 comments. And I said, it's only got 10 comments. Is it really that controversial, or is it really that, like, well-discussed? Like, it doesn't seem like the action is actually happening on this issue. The question has arisen, like, should Drupal Core try to provide its own CSS, or is there some sort of, like, industry standard, method for having a theme out there, such as Bootstrap for CSS? Is anybody there?
I'm here.
Okay, so Ted's there.
I think I pointed this article out to Mike. I thought it was really interesting. I actually haven't read, I think the last time I checked the core issue, it had 8 comments, but then I hadn't read Mark made a response to somebody else's question because somebody else was like, yeah, I don't think that's a very good idea. Basically, the idea that, provide, I guess it was a Bootstrap sort of sub-theme, it seemed like, and the idea was getting off the island to say, okay, why should we rebuild a system like this for responsive design when there are outside ones that the PHP community, different front-end communities use, so let's leverage that instead of making our own. Seemed like a good idea, but then I did read quickly just some of the other comments, and I guess one of the problems though is that front end moves so fast that if we included something in Drupal 8, would it seem old by the time Drupal 9 came out? Would people be sort of cursing that it's in core at that point? I don't know. It seems like front end's kind of an interesting situation in Drupal because nobody really thinks that Drupal looks good out of the box. And it seems like in Drupal 7, most people, if they're subtheming, or a lot of people when they're subtheming, are going to be starting from one of, 3 or 4 major subthemes.
It's kind of a natural discussion to have, though, right? Because we just went through this huge, I don't want to use the word upheaval, but for Drupal 8, where we replaced a lot of custom code on the back end with code invented somewhere else.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense. Well, where else can we do that? And, a big pile of low-hanging fruit is on the front end, I think.
I mean, to me, I almost want to, go back to the, was it Snowman? Was Jeff Eaton's project when the small core debate was happening that, there could almost be, a publicly accessible version of Drupal that you would download that would have some of these a Bootstrap, core theme and a couple of modules and maybe even some sample content and, stuff that was already there to make the onboarding process easy. And we do currently have the, the standard installation and the minimal installation, but I actually generally like the standard installation when I'm installing a new site. I don't usually go for minimal because there's just too many things that are turned off. I want something just in between standard and minimal, but then I want one that's standard easy. that does have maybe this theme, and maybe it could even ask you, like when you have a translation, right? Would you like to download one of these pretty themes? You know,
I think that would be tough.
That was the hope of Drupal Gardens, as far as I know from, you know, talking to those guys, where that was your out-of-the-box solution, where not only can you go in and create an easy back-end because you can't control the modules, but, by the way, pick one of these four really cool, you know, looks and feels, and then just change a couple of colors, and you're good to go.
I think it sort of gets also to the point of, was it Larry's article we talked about a couple of times ago about, you know, learning to say no, or, you know, I think from my perspective, it's admitting that Drupal is not for everybody. And if Drupal is not for everybody, the sites that are actually going to be made on Drupal are people, I mean, usually somebody's putting a significant amount of time into a front-end solution. And does it really matter that Drupal doesn't look good out of the box, because people are going to be spending a significant amount of time and resources on making a unique site that looks really different. And, you know, there is a bootstrap contrib theme that's out there that people can use if they want to.
Well, I think part of the argument of the blog post was that while the work done in D8 with Twig is great, it's not enough to really leverage, you know, a third-party theme or a third-party front end. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
It's not enough to leverage it in contrib? Like, it doesn't provide enough to contrib, or it should be just in core?
I think, if I recall the article correctly, I believe his name was Mark, right? Mark Carver, who wrote the blog post, said that, you know, replacing PHP template with Twig was great, but it was just a small piece of the overall pie of really re-architecting the theme system. And if we want to re-architect the theme system, we should do it in such a way so that it makes it much easier for us as a community to take external front-end projects like Bootstrap and some of the other ones and just kind of bolt them on to Drupal with a very, very thin layer.
But in core?
I don't know. In core or as part of contrib, I just think right now, you know, that's why the Bootstrap theme for Drupal has so much code, is because it has to kind of do that. You know, I'm going to use air quotes here, translation between Drupal core and Bootstrap. I think I think his argument was the amount of code for the Bootstrap theme should be minimal, because all that stuff should be being done by Drupal core, so that any front end projects can bolt onto it a little bit easier.
But I think also the other part is, and we should ship with an external framework. We shouldn't sort of rebuild, you know, redo the wheel. We should ship with one that already is popular and a lot of people use.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of his argument. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, because if you read the article is super interesting. And then there's a comment from somebody else in that article, which is, you know, more than a few paragraphs. And then Mark responds to that with almost another blog post in the comments.
Yeah, the comment reply is so gigantic.
If you do want to read this blog post, don't stop at the comments. Read the comments. And as of right now, there's only 5 or 6 total comments, but 2 of them are really, really meaty.
Yeah. I found a couple typos. I'm just kidding.
Meaty / with typos.
Very good. So I thought it was interesting, because it seems like there's a couple of things that can happen, right? So we could do nothing as a community and, well, I don't say do nothing, but kind of keep the status quo where, you know, as a community, we keep on improving and shipping Drupal with some core themes, you know, that kind of homegrown. Another option, I think it was actually mentioned in the comments, was, well, we're going to semantic versioning, so maybe like in 8.1 or 8.2 or 8.3, we can add new, you know, core themes that may or may not be based on other front-end frameworks. And then basically replace some. If we have a you know, one that's gotten long in the tooth, like, you know, Bardic has for D7, you know, maybe it's time to jettison that and replace it with something else in future point release.
So the other thing I think is big in the front end that, you know, I haven't followed closely is the inclusion of that classy theme that is meant to be sub-themed. Is that a first for Drupal to have a theme that's sort of designed as a sub-theme?
Well, in core.
Or as a base theme, yeah.
In core, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's definitely a new thing. And it also, it inspired a lot of changes to the theme system to make that kind of a theme easier to extend, because you ultimately want to override most of it, you know. If the whole point of using it is that you may eventually override all of it, but you want to have a good starting point that makes it easy to copy and paste this template and hack it.
And so does like Drupal 8, the front end system. We said that the Bootstrap theme and Drupal 7 has to have a lot of code. If you're sub-theming classy and strap, I guess trapping on Bootstrap to on top of classy would not be easy, I guess.
No, I think actually it comes up in the discussion that the fact that classy exists is going to make all sub-theming easier, because it's almost like a template for creating a parent theme. You know, there's even the way sub-theming works in Drupal 8, you know, you can actually extend a template instead of wholesale copying it. You can really just override just one little piece of something. You don't actually have to override the whole entire template file. So there's lots and lots and lots of advantages, because there's like the idea of like a named section of a template that would let you say, I just want to override this named section of it. And I'm probably using the wrong word, but it's object oriented templates.
All right, next story.
So it says the Drupal ecosystem is consolidating rapidly again by Steve Burge at OS Training. And I guess this is talking about the whole thing where, you know, originally Wunderkraut was formed and then Phase 2 and Treehouse partnered up. And then just recently we've had the FFW thing happened, Media Current became part of Code and Theory, and so on, right? There's a lot of these. Phase 2 added Open Sorcery and Superstar Media, Gov Delivery acquired New Civic, and Code Drop and Previous Next merged. So there's like, actually, I didn't know all of these off the top of my head, but yeah, I definitely had a firsthand knowledge of some of this, you know. But the funny thing was, because it's kind of like tied to public announcements, we found out just about when the rest of the world found out as employees of FFW. So, you know, like, I'm sure somebody knew before me, but we were called on Friday morning. And then by the time we were told, the employees, you know, the press release had gone out 5 minutes before. So we were finding out at the same time that the press was.
Yeah. I included it as one of the stories just because it's a nice roundup of acquisitions in the past few months.
Yeah, so it's good to note that this happened, and I guess this would be a good point, you know, to point back to and say, hey, by the way, you know, 2015 was a big year for mergers, right? End of 2014, beginning of 2015. So check that out, and you can see, I guess there's links to all the different press releases there if you wanted to check one of those out in more detail.
Next. Thanks, Steve. Story.
All right, this one is by Tim Millwood, and it talks about using Composer. Am I right?
Yeah, so I wanted to mention this because I've been playing around after I was publicly shamed last week by Michelle, which has actually worked because I've actually come quite a long way, but I'm gonna pocket that for now, and we'll have Michelle back on in a couple of podcasts where we can follow up that discussion. But I've actually built a couple of Drupal projects just playing around with Composer, and to the point now where it all kind of makes sense to me, or that portion of it at least. But the idea here is that if you want to build a project, a Drupal project with Composer, as opposed to like Drush Make, for example, one of the things Composer needs to know about is any dependencies that, you know, different say, modules have. And the way that modules can easily inform composer of dependencies is through this composer.json file that gets included with your module. So I actually wasn't even going to add this to the podcast this week, but Ted, I know that, was it last week or the week before, you mentioned that you have a new D8 module out, and I said, oh, well, here's a great opportunity to hopefully publicly shame Ted if he hasn't added a composer.json file. I have a feeling.
Nice try.
Exactly. See? Fantastic. I knew you'd come through.
actually, I didn't even... There is a composer JSON in there, but I didn't make it.
So how did it get there?
Take a guess. Something asked me if I wanted to create it.
Something asked you if you on Drupal.org?
Nope.
PHP Storm.
No. Ryan?
Well, are you using, you know, the command line composer to like convert?
Oh, I know what it was.
Your module?
What was it, Mike?
It was the new Drupal console.
It was.
Wow.
I was generating a module. I was like, okay, I'll try Drupal console. So I was making one of my first Drupal 8 modules, and I was like, oh, I'll install console. I think I installed it once, but I didn't have it, so I reinstalled it, and I was like, okay, generate module, and it's like, would you like to make a composer file? And it's like, sure. So, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's actually kind of funny, because the whole time we were talking about this article, for me, the words composer in Drupal 8 and console are actually the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why you would even talk about composer and Drupal without talking about the console project. But I guess, well, Tim didn't really talk about it here in this blog post.
Well, I mean, but you could do a composer install without having console.
You could.
Absolutely.
But
well, I mean,
just get the console, everyone. Yeah. Is it DrupalConsole.org? Is that right?
If you Google Drupal console, you'll find it.
Oh, really? If you Google it, that'll work, Ted?
Yeah. Thanks. So Google is
appreciate that.
Oh, DrupalConsole.com.
Oh my goodness.
Google.com. I'm sure Bing would work too, I'm sure.
Yeah. So basically, the article by Tim Millwood, Composer and Contrib, Step 1, the TLDR on this one is, if you are a Drupal 8 module maintainer, add a composer.json file.
But done. If you are writing a Drupal 8 module, step 0, download the Drupal console.
Yeah. And actually, you know what? I'm going to even append what I just said. It doesn't matter if it's a contrib module or not. If it's a custom module and it has dependencies, even more reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So.
And I think you can use it for Drupal 7 too. There's a project for working
with Composer.
Yeah.
Yep. Tim has been writing. He's had a series of really nice Drupal and Composer blog posts. So definitely check out his website. The link is in the show notes, but it's tim.millwoodonline.co.uk.
I also made my first Symfony console project. With not Drupal console, but using the Symfony console library, and you know, use Composer for that too, and beginning to become a convert.
All right, let's table that, because I have a feeling that could lead to a much
longer discussion. Whole other thing. Yeah. So, Mike, have you got your soundboard ready over there?
yes, I can. I don't have any good sounds though. Oh man, no, I don't have anything. I don't have any timpani, if that's what you're asking for.
I got okay. One.
Well,
meow.
Good one. Anyway, this is it's hard to say that, like, you know, we should bow our heads in silence, but it is definitely a moment of reflection as Lullabot has announced they're not going to be putting out any more episodes of the Drupalize Me podcast.
You're doing it out of order.
Yeah, it's totally going out of order. Oh,
what just happened?
You made me do the meow for that, which wasn't.
Oh perfect. Man! Wow, I do. Okay,
that meow was not.
Well, that's right. We'll come back to
all the
story
stories
four.
And tabs, and I clicked on the wrong tab.
No, no, let's talk about the Drupalize.me one. That's cool.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, the Drupalize Me podcast is going offline for a couple of months, but they say they're regrouping and they'll be back.
They were feeling the pressure.
So it would have been nice if they had said, you know, there's these other cool Drupal podcasts out there that you might want to subscribe to. Example, Talking Drupal. Example, Modules Unraveled. Example, Drupal Easy. Am I missing some big ones? If you speak Spanish, there are some good ones.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys listen to that's Drupal related?
I've been listening to the Media Current Dropcast.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yep, I've been listening to that one lately.
Good one.
I do want to mention sources there. This kind of bummed me out when I saw that, because I'm a regular listener of Drupalize.me. And I will point back to, there was a podcast a few months ago on Drupalize.me about mental health and the Drupal community or something like that. I'm trying to find it right now. Here it is. Drupalize.me podcast 61, Mental Health and Open Source, from April 10th. One of the best Drupal related podcasts I've heard. Especially if you work from home or if you just work a lot, it's a really, really interesting podcast. I would highly recommend it.
Was that their? That wasn't their last one, was it?
No, nope, nope. They've had a few since then. So we look forward to them, you know, relaunching stronger than ever.
Were they the first Drupal podcast? As the Lullabot podcast, was this the first Drupal one?
I think so.
Predates the Drupal Easy.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that was definitely out before Drupal Easy.
Yeah. No, we copied them. Yes.
No, so a lot of people got their introduction, got their, I feel like I found out a lot about Drupal via the Lullabot podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, a lot of people did.
Drupalized me, but originally.
Lullabot is why I started using Drupal, because they helped build a website for This Week in Tech. And I, you know, was watching Leo Laporte talking about his website, and I was doing podcasts. I was already doing podcasts. And then he said, oh, I'm doing my website in Drupal. And I said, oh, it's Drupal. I had installed that before and I hated it, but I'm going to try it again because it was mentioned here. So let me check it out. And then he had Jeff Robbins on talking about how they built the site. And I don't know if you guys remember, Ted Serbinski was one of the early Lullabots.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's how I got into Drupal. Was I had installed it before and I had played around with it. But then once it was, you know, I heard that they were using it to do a podcasting website, I said, I got to check this out. So. That's it.
So, Mike, will you insert a 2-minute moment of silence?
Yep. Go ahead. Stay tuned, Ted. I'll put it in right here. Go.
I never listen.
Why would you?
So the number 11 keeps ringing in my head. Why is that?
Number 11.
11. 11.
Was the number 12 ringing in your head a few minutes ago, and now it's 11?
Yeah.
As of this morning, at some point, there are only 11 critical issues left for Drupal 8. So I figured we'd start mentioning this every podcast, what that number's at and what the status is. Of course, when we get down to zero, and I think we go a couple of weeks without any new ones, that's when the first Drupal 8 release candidate will come out. And, you know, who knows, maybe that will happen sometime around DrupalCon Barcelona, which means we have about 2 weeks to get 11 banged out, which is a bit challenging, but we'll see what happens.
Well, based on the 80-20 rule, fixing the last 11 issues could take a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the 90-10 rule, or whatever your favorite version of that rule is, the 99-1 rule.
All right, shall we talk about web-enabled?
Yeah, web-enabled. It's a fancy hosting platform made by our friends in Colorado, Salim and his team. Salim and his team. It rhymes pretty well. What do we use web-enabled for? What do we got?
I mean, the main reason I use them on a lot of projects is if I need for some reason to be able to SSH into the server, into the dev server or the production server, and make changes there. Very easy to do. There's other hosting companies that don't let you do that, either on the low end or the high end. But if you want complete control over your development environment, you know, including SSH access, web-enabled is the way to go. Not to mention their customer support is fantastic. you know, whenever there's a problem, you can either use their live chat or you can open up a ticket. And I've never had the case where it's taken them more than a few hours to get back to me on just about anything. Combine that with the fact that there's a team development where I can give people read or write access to repositories. It's easy to push a dev environment to production, also on web-enabled. All those things add up to just a really solid hosting, development and production hosting environment for Drupal developers.
So you can give them read and or write?
Yes.
Give them write without read?
No. I'm sorry. Read and write? How'd you say that? You can give them read access or read-write access.
Yes.
How's that? Is that better, Ted?
That's better, yeah.
Golly.
Is that or and right? Have we invented a new phraseology there?
You know, I ran across, there was a an article not too long ago. I was just looking for it. I couldn't find it, so I don't want to mention where I saw it. But it was an article with an interview with Salim from Web Enabled.
Excellent.
All about dev panel and that stuff. And
we'll have to link to that in the show notes.
John from Western New York did it. John, John, I'm blanking on your last name right now.
Weixnauer? Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, I think he's the one who did the interview with Salim.
Oh,
anyways,
really?
I saw. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Yeah, John P. something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John P. Weixnauer. I had it right. John P. Weixnauer. You're close enough.
Actually, I guess I'm not sure that I've ever pronounced his last name, so
I'll just forget read it. Myself. You haven't said it out loud.
I don't. Thinking I haven't. If you said it anywhere close to how it should be pronounced, I've definitely never pronounced it.
All right.
Or at least pronounced it nearly correct.
Hey, we've got some feedback from last week. Actually, it wasn't.
It's not. It's not a voicemail though. No cheesecapes.
Someone. I don't. It was a comment. It was a comment from a podcast a couple weeks ago when we were talking about the U.S. We mentioned the U.S. Forest Service. I forget who actually had on, but I do want to read the comment in its entirety. It's only a couple sentences. It comes from Danielle. Great episode. Just wanted to point out the U.S. Forest Service, not forestry, is part of USDA and not the Department of Interior. There are a few really awesome Forest Service efforts currently using Drupal. All of USDA is moving to Drupal with many programs already running Drupal. Check out the Climate Change Resource Center for one example from the USFS, the U.S. Forest Service. And that's at www.fs.usda.gov/CCRC.
So did this person email you, were they part of the, I forget what it is, forestry or Forest Service?
I don't know. You know as much as I know at this point. I believe it was a comment on the website. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, this is the point in the show where we normally come to picks of the week. And Jay, I'm very intrigued by your pick of the week, as it appears to use custom entities.
You saw that, huh? I chose project/group. I'm building an intranet for a financial company up in New York. And they said to me, hey, we're coming off of an old D6 site that's joined by an HR system and all kinds of other fun stuff like that. And we use OG and we exploit it and the whole site's built around it and we hate it. So I said, okay. So we talked about building a whole brand new Drupal 7 site, which we're doing right now. And they wanted to see, could this all of this be done with Relativity? And I said, yeah, the answer is yes. But I had gotten to a couple of points where I started getting a little bit nervous as far as the membership side of groups. So I started investigating. I actually installed OG, pulled it right back out again, and then I found this guy, project/group. It's a really cool, smaller footprint alternative to OG that I think gives you increased functionality and also expandability. So it's something to check out if you're looking for some kind of a subscription-based membership type group scenario, and you don't want to use Relativity.
Well, and it looks like this module has only ever existed for Drupal 7,
right,
which is somewhat of an advantage, and it has been around for a while, even though it's never had a 1.0 release. It still says beta 3.
It's interesting if you install it, how it works. It's actually pretty elegant. It's pretty cool.
But yeah, it sounds pretty interesting. It sounds like it has a lot of the same things that you would want to get out of organic groups without really having to have like all of the different add-on modules organic groups wants.
That's the reason I went for it, because there are no add-ons. It's a module, and it does everything out of the box that it says it's going to, and then some. If you're crafty with entities and ECK, I'm sure you could do all kinds of crazy cool stuff to it, you know, above and beyond. But out of the box, it's some good stuff there.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Jay.
My pleasure.
Ted, would you like to go next?
So I chose this D8 module that I made. Sort of because I had made actually a module similar to this, or basically it allows you to show and hide blocks based on token conditions. So the idea that, oh, I want to show a block if the current user is the author of this current node, you could compare two tokens, the current user user ID and the author user ID, and show a block based off that. It was interesting doing it because now they've made a conditions plugin for Drupal core. So I think this is part of the people who are making Drupal 8 rules pushed for this. And so the idea is when you look at Drupal 8 and you have node, you know, show this block on certain node types or on certain paths, that is from a condition plugin that's provided in Drupal core. And other modules can provide condition plugins. So in making this module, I didn't have to alter the form in any way. I just said, okay, here's my condition plugin. I subclassed a plugin, a condition plugin base class, and you know, provided my build configuration form function. So I feel like it's pretty elegant, even compared to earlier in the Drupal 8 cycle. Though it does sort of I think I've put a couple links to some issues, some core issues on the project page. One of them is that looking at redesigning the block UI the block configuration UI, because as it is now, it assumes that all the condition plugins, you only have one of them, meaning that in my case, if you're comparing tokens, you might want to have two conditions. And also, Drupal core assumes that if you have condition plugins, you want to show all of them on the block form. So as soon as you install rules, you start to have like 25 condition plugins loaded automatically, which is kind of weird. So it's, I don't know, I think it's an example of, you know, making Drupal 8 way more flexible, but then having to rethink other parts of Drupal if we're going to do that.
Well, and I think you said this, but this is only a Drupal 8 module.
Yeah. You could do something similar to this in Drupal 7, but it would be a totally different code. It wouldn't really share very much code at all. This is one of those cases where there is a .module file, but only for the help text or the helpers, whatever it is in Drupal 8. But everything else is just in one class file, and I think it's only like 200 lines long, so really shows, I think, if you're looking at custom coding or looking at contrib modules in Drupal 8, like how much you can do with very little code.
So it's really, it's just done with one class. That sounds great.
Yep. It was fun.
Sounds really slick.
Well, if you say so.
You only get slick modules from a guy named T-Bone.
So the other thing it points out, though, is there, like, how much work there is, I think, in Drupal 8 left besides just the criticals. Because right now, when I was looking at the tokens that are exposed or the tokens we have available, I feel like there are less tokens than there were in Drupal 7. And it's hard in Drupal 8 or Drupal 7, like what tokens were provided by Drupal core and which were provided by the Entity API module. Because, like, for example, there's a token for, if you have an entity reference on a node, there's a token for that, but there's no subtokens for that, where in Drupal 7 you would have tokens for all the fields that are on that reference. But that's not there in Drupal 8 yet. And that's considered a major issue, not critical, which you know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what is, like, what I know, like, I've always heard, like, you know, release candidates will be, or Drupal's release candidate will be done or released when all the criticals are done, but how are majors considered in a full release? I don't know. Does anybody else know that answer?
No, I don't know.
It might just be down to triage.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it just means that as soon as there are zero criticals, that Drupal is ready, but...
Yeah. But there's issues for it, because I was looking, and actually there's tokens. There's an issue for solving how to handle array tokens, where you have multiple sub-values. And you can see, I'm not sure if this is the finished version, but on, like, a user... the user token with roles, there's all these sub tokens like join and first and concatenated together and raw value, which I'm assuming will later come to the field tokens. But I thought it was pretty, like, the ones that are available for stuff like user roles were really robust and really impressive. So I think there's sort of some issues for getting that done. I think I linked to them on my module page, because really my module page right now, it can do some things that are pretty cool, but once the tokens are fully flushed out, it'll be a lot more powerful, and just mostly because of the token system, not because anything I'm going to add to my module.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Well, Mike, this module is giving me deja vu. Would you like to talk about it?
Well, mine's going to be real fast. I wanted just to give it a second mention, you know, the field group module. This is one of those modules that when people haven't seen it in action and then see it in action, it's really a big eye-opener. Especially, you know, I find myself, and I think like Jay, I use the horizontal tab groups all the time now on Node at Edit Pages.
Vertical is better.
I don't know. It shrinks the layout, the overall length of the page drastically, depending on, you know, what your Node... your node form looks like. And it really, with a minimum amount of effort, you can really make the node add edit page, or any form for that matter, any form API form, really a lot easier to navigate for content administrators. So if you're not using it, you should definitely check it out.
Oh, I just mean vertical tabs versus horizontal tabs.
No, I'm going to disagree and say horizontal tabs are better. And let's throw down and let's find out.
One for me is on a mobile phone. If you're trying to edit your site on a phone, you're always having to scroll all the way back up to the top to find something.
Okay, all right.
And one thing would solve this, if there was a sticky button on either vertical or horizontal tab groups, which would be probably a five-line change, and I should probably just go in there and add it, a little tiny bit of JavaScript that just like the sticky table headers. If that was an option, especially for mobile phones,
there you go.
That would be make both of these better.
All right, you should get on that.
Yep.
The other awesome thing that it does is provides multi-step forms. So when I was making Unity form, people were like, "Oh, I'd love to have a multi-page form where you hit, you know, next page and you're presented with another set of fields." So if you use their, I forget what exactly it's called within field group, but it'll allow you to do that.
Yeah, it's one of the display types in field group.
And what's your pick of the week, Mr. Price?
Well, I was checking out the Lullabot newsletter this morning, and part one of this blog post I think came out last week, and part two came out today. It's by a Lullabot named Matt Robinson, and he went to a conference called MozCon. And at first I thought it had something to do with Mozilla, but it turns out that Moz is an SEO firm. So this is this company that does a lot of SEO, you know, and writing about SEO, has a conference, and they had a lot of really interesting speakers. But sort of the theme of the weekend was that, you know, SEO is dead, long live SEO, that now it's really just down to having quality content and solid branding and clear communication, and not so much about, you know, keyword stuffing and link building and posting 15 really just non-relevant blog posts every day just to make sure that your homepage gets updated on a regular basis. Like, quality, 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 apparently. And there's some really interesting tips now, too, because this article that came out today was talking about so many of your, you know, so much of the traffic to your site now is coming from basically non-referrers, like social networks, mobile apps, you know, email campaigns, and other sorts of like forums and that kind of stuff, where it's really almost impossible to tell where the traffic came from. So there's some tips for trying to break down, you know, like take out the traffic to your homepage, start looking at the traffic to individual pages, and then look at the campaigns you've been running, right? Have you been trying to link to that page on Twitter? Have you been trying to link to that page, you know, via YouTube video? Has that gone out in an email newsletter somewhere? And trying to sort of triangulate where this mystery traffic is coming from. And it's not going to be a huge, huge percentage, but it's going to be able to help you tell whether or not your marketing efforts are paying off. So, yeah, definitely interesting. It's like a summary of a bunch of stuff that happened at the conference. And I assume, you know, if you click through to the conference website, you'll be able to find some more very specific, you know, case studies and war stories that are out there. So that was that one for me. And we have some upcoming events coming up in around the world, specifically Drupal Camp Pennsylvania. It looks like, Mike, I think you did talk about this, that your Drupal Career Online class is starting up soon.
That's correct.
And you have an open house. Maybe by the time you hear this, it'll be just about time to go to the online open house.
Yeah, we actually have two of them going on, where we have an in-person one at Stetson University that starts in about a month. And the open house for that one's actually this afternoon. So as soon as we hang up, I'm going to be heading over to Stetson and hosting that and talking to potential students. And that's an in-person class in Central Florida. And then obviously the online one, where anybody from anywhere in the world can join, that open house is coming up. Oh boy, I should know the date off the top of my head, but we have a couple. I think we have about another week and a half before that one. So if you're interested, let us know, and we will get you all the relevant information.
Very good. And Ted, you have your online Drupal 7 module development class.
Yeah, which I'm sort of playing around with pricing there now. So I have it priced for $89, which is almost half of what it was. So it's, you know, guiding you through three modules, some challenge exercises. I'm there to ask questions if you have questions. So if you're interested, I'm not sure when I'm going to raise that back up, but I'm just sort of playing around with what, you know, how many enrollments I would get for lowering the price. So if you act fast...
Well, you got to get one of those sponsors like Brian Lewis.
Where I put it on his site?
Well, no, but he got somebody to pay for all of his classes so that he can offer them for free, I guess.
Are you
I think we covered that in last week's podcast, maybe.
Are you volunteering?
Sponsored by
Ryan Price
Disney Productions. Yes. very cool. And then, obviously, DrupalCon Barcelona. Mike, you said you're going to be going. Super jealous. All of the jamón that you'll be consuming, and manchego, and churros, and café, and deliciousness.
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, and Drupal.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I actually, I don't know if I should say this on the podcast. I actually have a hotel room very close, and I would consider sharing that hotel room with someone, the right person. Obviously, you have to go through the full interview process with my wife as well. But past that, you know. If you're going and you're looking for a place to stay, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be very picky about it. So let me know. Although ask Ted.
Accomodaciones de Anello.
Ted and I have roomed together at many a Drupal cons, and I think I'm pretty easy going. I just have some very simple ground rules about, you know. Well, we'll just. every joke I had was like filthy right there.
Yeah.
No. Like
leave your slippers at the door.
Yeah, I was trying to get Ted to go, but he's, you know.
Well, you never know. Maybe there's some major price break in flights.
All right, check it out. Get on Kayak. Kayak.com. We'll hook you up.
I'm on it.
Yeah. This is just about the end of the podcast, so I want to make some plugs. You can find us on the Twitter and other social networking sites as Drupal Easy. And shout out to our friend also here in Florida, Andrew M. Riley. I go by Liberator with the Web 2.0 spelling that's missing the last vowel. T-Bone goes by Ted Bow for some reason. And you can also find 6 Mile Tech, where he talks about his training classes. Mike, you are Ultimike. And Jay, where do we find you on the internet?
Jeppy64 at Twitter, J-E-P-P-Y-6-4, which is my high school wrestling coach's nickname for me.
Whoa.
Oh. Yep.
Bring Jeppy. It back.
Yep, Jeppy. So, Jeppy64 on Twitter.
And just a shout out for myself, if you are in the Orlando area and you want to hear all about all the podcasting fun stuff that I do, it is, I believe, next Wednesday is a WordPress meetup at the local co-working space, Canvas. And I will be talking about podcasting, and then somebody else will be talking about how they integrate SoundCloud with WordPress. But I'm pretty sure most of that will carry over to Drupal pretty easily for promoting and publishing podcasts. So it's going to be all podcast meetup there. And then finally, we have the 5 questions. Mr. J, what's something that you do that's interesting or notable that's not Drupal?
Most people don't know it, but I'll share it. I played baseball for a lot of years. I actually quit when I was 40, so I went on to become an elite player, high school / college, even in some case minor league pro catching instructor here locally here in South Florida. Haven't done it in a couple of years. I've been off the field, but I did that for a good 7-8 years straight.
Now, Ted and Ryan, calm down, because I know you guys are sports freaks. And I'm sure you guys have a lot of questions for Ted, but I'm gonna stop. I mean, for Jay, but I'm gonna stop you right there.
I wouldn't know where to start with questions, but it seems impressive.
Okay, that's good. I just want to rein you in, because I know how you are when we talk about sports.
What's a piece of software that you installed recently, Jay, on your computer or your phone?
Oh, I guess OpenOffice would be the most recent one. Very, very cool. I don't really
okay,
do
but
much.
OpenOffice or LibreOffice? Because there's a fork in progress.
I didn't want to have to bring this up.
It was actually OpenOffice. Should I be ducking?
Well, that's one that's run by Sun Freedom Haters.
All right.
I guess it's Oracle now, right? Oracle, definitely right. Freedom Haters.
We're not going to publish this podcast, sorry.
I'm going to rip that out and do the right thing, I promise.
Actually, I think LibreOffice gets updated more often, which is the reason why I use it, is they have new features and new bug fixes a little bit more often. But yeah, what's something else out there? What's something that you would like to do, but that's still a little scary to you?
Mastering Git. I'm going to be honest. I'll put it out there. I build a lot of big Drupal sites, but I'm horrible at Git. On any kind of deep level, I know my handful of go-to commands, and that's about it. So, I got a long way to go with mastering Git, and Gitflow, and all of that stuff.
I mean, from my perspective, though, when you're talking about using Git for what you're using, you probably would end up putting like a Drush make file in there, and maybe some theme files or something like that, but a lot of stuff you need doesn't really need to be versioned, because you're using just off-the-shelf modules, right?
Pretty much, and everything that I do is all data, specific database type stuff, unless I load a module, which, like we already talked about, is very rare. So, but that, if I could learn to master something, that's something I'd love to learn how to really get in deep with, because I just find it fascinating. I really do.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the thing that really made me want to have to learn Git was working with other people, and having to like check my stuff into their repository. So if I'm doing a project all by myself, it's really easy to get lazy really fast.
Sure.
So what was the last exotic animal that you hand fed? Is there an animal you pet or fed? This is a real question, we promise.
I'm not going to go there. I don't know any exotic animals. I haven't pet any. I haven't hand fed
Jay,
any.
Jay, you live in South Florida. You must be like wrestling giant pythons all the time.
I think Jay wins this for not feeding exotic animals.
Well, my response is this. Ha, really? I can't go there, man. I just don't know how to answer that.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, the pythons and the iguanas are all over South Florida.
I don't do reptiles. No way. No.
I've been waiting for somebody to answer like this.
So at what point did you really feel like you were part of the Drupal community? Like, what was your tipping point of Drupal for you?
My tipping point came, in general, it was when I was able to actually get through speaking at a Drupal camp without kind of self-imploding, stuttering on words, forgetting where I was, totally spacing out and forgetting what I was talking about. Public speaking is really what it came down to. That was my tipping point where I felt welcomed enough where I was able to kind of ease up and calm down and deliver what I was trying to deliver without fear of being, you know, ridiculed, stuff thrown at me or whatever.
Awesome. When did you stop getting stuff thrown at you?
Let's see. Well, the first meetup I ever went to at the Broward Drupal Users Group, I actually presented. And my presentation was I had no clue about what I was doing. So that was my introduction into talking in front of a bunch of Drupal people. But I think it was probably Austin, Texas, where I actually stood up there and I was like, wait a minute. These people are not going to throw anything at me. They want to hear what I have to say. I just need to say it where they can understand me. So that was my tipping point, Austin, Texas, a couple of years ago, where I was able to get through that presentation where I was like, oh, wow, I did pretty good.
Awesome. So, you can also find our podcast at drupaleasy.com/podcast. And we're on the iTunes store and all of the podcast stores, including Stitcher. And if you do find, you know, one of your favorite podcast apps and it's hard to subscribe to our show, please do send us a note and we will try to work with the app developer or the directory and make sure that we're listed there. And you can also call and leave us a voicemail. It's 321-396-2340. That's a U.S. number, of course. And we always post a lot of upcoming stories we might be talking about on Delicious using the tag Drupal Easy Podcast. Mr. J. Epstein, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. It was great. I had a lot of fun.
And to all the listeners, thank you for listening for the last 2 hours.
Holy cow, yes.
And after I put all the potato recipes on at the end, this is going to be a sitter, I'm going to say.
I don't know what that means.
It's going to be one of those ones where you're like, is it over yet? Is it over? No. Got to sit down and keep listening.
Okay.
I don't know. What's an example? A marathon? I don't know.
Okay, let's go with marathon.
If you put this on during your run, you might have discovered that you ran an extra 2 miles.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Should we sign off and I'll go ahead and we'll play the whole simple test song to close things out?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Jay, as Ryan said, thank you very much. And Ted and Ryan, always great to talk to you guys as well.
Good to be on.
And we'll see you on the next Drupal Easy podcast. See ya!
See ya!
Ladies and gentlemen, it is with deepest pride and greatest pleasure that we welcome your patch to Drupal. And now we invite you to sit back and relax while the Drupal Association proudly presents your contribution.
Lights up.
Simple test. Put your patches to my test. Post a git diff to the issue queue and we will do the rest. Assert this and test that. You'll be done in seconds flat. Write a valid expectation. This bot's never on vacation. When you're done, you can play. After all, folks, it's LA. And an event here is never second best. Go on, expand the menus, click the boxes, then kill simple test. Let's click link, Drupal set, assert raw and Drupal get. Now it runs, try not to fret, just go and surf the internet. You're alone and you're scared, but your vars are all declared. Don't be hurried or complaining, just 3,000 tests remaining. Prism Joe, talk to chicks, waiting on diagnostics.
And it's all in PHP that you can bet.
The running on a mass. I hope your patch will pass the simple test.
If you're stressed, it's more testing, I suggest.
Simple test, simple test, simple test.
I tell you, and I'm not jesting, a test bot that is not testing, it's not whole without a patch to wait upon. All those good old days when Piffer was still shiny, but how quickly now the drop bit moves along. For 10 years now I've been rusting, getting not much more than dusting. No new features built to meet your changing needs. Most days the servers sit around all idle. Slow and old and lazy, but miss a sprint, an oopsie-daisy, what the hell? Random fail, this'll be the final nail. D8 head is broken dead, and things are spinning off the rail. The backlog, we're in trouble, get some servers on the double. While the infra team is moving, I'll be cancel and re-queuing. The queue, where to go? All the tests are now postponed, and Alex Bot's about to lose his head. You know, if he snaps, oh man, we don't want that. So fix the test.
So fix the test.
Fix the test.
Oh, fix the test.
Simple test. Simple test. One more tool in our tool chest. It might seem to you a nuisance. We don't care.
Yes, we're obsessed.
With white space. With intense spaces. Please don't take offense. While the screen is still a-glowing, it keeps turning. It keeps going. One by one, all green lit, and then you're done. Now it's time to celebrate your great success. Tonight you'll prop your feet up and go to a meet. A simple test, simple test, simple test.
Yeah, I was just going to eat this last potato here.
Is it fried or baked or sweet?
Baked. But it was, it's like a small potato. And then we have this, like, blue cheese curry sauce.
Metaphorically or literally? A small potato.
Blue cheese curry sauce.
Mm-hmm.
I've so never the heard trick of those to making it together.
Well, we had it. It was this like restaurant that claimed to be an Indian restaurant. It was not an Indian restaurant. They had foods with Indian names, but one of the things they had was these little fingerling potatoes with blue cheese curry sauce, and we tried it, and that was the only thing we remember about that place. Everything else was totally unmemorable.
Yeah,
and we have since stolen that and. We make it all the time.
Is it like those little white round potatoes that you're having?
What I just had was that, but the best ones are fingerling potatoes because they get really nice and crispy.
Are those bigger?
No, they look kind of like a little bit bigger than your thumb. They're like long. They're not round.
From eating the potato.
I've never heard. I gotta look this up. Fingerling?
Fingerling potatoes.
Jay, you don't have anything to do for the next couple days, right?
I'm all good, man.
A lot of times they also come in fun colors because, you know, it's like marketing. They're like red and yellow and purple.
I see that.
And
look at that. I've never seen those before. You get them at Publix? Where do you get them?
Yeah. We've gotten them at Aldi, at Publix, at Costco. It was pretty much the three places where we shop.
You know, we were one day we were overseas. We stopped in a grocery store. It wasn't in Belgium. I think it was in Germany actually. Because normally what we do is we'll go on long, like day long hikes. So we'll stop at a grocery store and pack our backpacks with sandwich stuff. And we found this grocery store and we walked in and it was kind of like an Aldi, kind of like a discount type off brand grocery store. And we go in there, we buy everything we need for, like, sandwiches, and nothing looked particularly great. It was just kind of all, you know, so-so looking food. We walk out of there, and I realize I had no cash, it's in a very small shopping center. So I'm looking around for a cash machine, and I see another store, and I didn't recognize the name of the store. So I walk over to that store and walk in the door, and it's literally right next door to the other one, and it's like a German Whole Foods. It was the weirdest thing. Like, there were two grocery stores right next to one another. One, like, kind of, like, low-end. The other one, like, very high-end. It was very bizarre.
That would never happen in America because all of the strip mall owners have, like, exclusivity agreements. Like, yeah. You can't have two Chinese restaurants in the same plaza because it just, you know, yeah. It's like competition with yourself.
It was bizarre. Like, I was really surprised when to see it. So... Okay. Oh, Ted left, and he's back. Okay, fantastic.
What did I miss? Culinary.
Oh, well, let's go back. Were you here for fingerling potatoes?
Is that Finger Lake or Finger Link?
Fingerling, L-I-N-G. I looked it up.
No.
I looked it up. I'm going to have to try some of this. I like the little potatoes. I like sweet potatoes of any shape, and then the more diminutive of the potatoes. I don't like the big honking, like Idaho baked potatoes.
Yeah, when I went to Sweden, every meal came with those little potatoes.
Yeah, little ones are good because you know what it is? I think it's like the surface area to like raw potato meat volume. Like I like more of the skin than the inside. So Ted, your thoughts on this?
Potatoes. Yeah, they're pretty good.
Do you eat potatoes?
Usually like French fries, you know.
All right.
I eat potatoes in other things usually.
What do you mean in other things? Like you stuff potatoes into like chicken breast?
No, I don't know. Maybe like don't some casseroles have potatoes? Moussaka has potatoes.
All right, so you're not like a big potato guy, it sounds like.
I don't usually have a baked potato with meal ever.
Well, I'm talking more than just baked potatoes. There's a lot of options.
I don't usually have, yeah, boiled potatoes or whatever.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. You're too good for us, I guess.
I didn't want to say it, but you
too
know.
Too uppity. All right. We good to go? Ryan, are you done?
I just got to finish the recipe while we're talking about it, though.
Yes, go ahead.
If you go to Pollo Tropical and you get their curry sauce, then you just take that home with you and you put some blue cheese in it. And that's essentially the curry sauce that we make.
Is that, do you literally do that, or do you actually?
We literally do that. We've tried to make it ourselves before, and we were like, maybe it would be easier to take blue cheese dressing and just add curry and mustard. We haven't gone the other way, but it's really hard to make salad dressing that tastes decent. So
do you do that like with other recipes, where you like, you know, I need a half gallon of like Big Mac sauce, and I'm going to mix that with something else.
Except for what comes with Big Mac sauce? No, actually, they sell a pretty reasonable facsimile of. Why are we talking about this? We talked about Big Mac sauce, but...
I tried to move on, but you said you wanted to finish the recipe, so I'm...
But now you're asking me about Big Mac sauce. They sell that at Winn-Dixie, though. You can just go buy... It's called sandwich dressing. It's basically Thousand Island with a little bit of relish in it.
Yeah.
I do not miss Winn-Dixie.
It's secret sauce.
What about steak fries, guys? Anybody? Steak fries?
Delicious.
You know what? They're too thick for me.
Not the best.
I like them. I like them thin. Like, who has good thin fries? Like, Steak and Shake.
Steak and Shake. Well, Jay, do you guys have two J's down there?
Yeah, we do.
Their fries are excellent.
They are. And this is memories of me growing up as a kid in the Bronx at all the old Bronx delis with the steak fries and gravy.
Oh, yeah.
The best.
I don't know if I've ever had two J's fries.
They're good.
Do you guys have two J's, Mike?
Yeah, we do. We do.
You got to go, like, get yourself, like, a burger or a grilled cheese sandwich or a tuna melt or something. Yep. Side of fries.
All right. Yeah, we got them done. I don't think there's one in Merritt Island. I think there's a couple in Melbourne, though.
Poutine, anyone?
Delicious. I just had a poutine for breakfast.
You don't know what poutine is?
No, what is it?
It's French fries and cheese curds with gravy. Yeah. It's a Canadian thing.
Real? I've never heard of it.
Good stuff.
Sounds fancy.
It's not really fancy.
Well, that fits in with Ted's uppityness about his potatoes. So.
It's kind of verging on Mike, gross, I mean, but it's very delicious.
Do you guys go to the French fry shops, though? Or the friteurs?
Oh, in Belgium? Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they put all kinds of stuff on. They don't ever put cheese curds on the fries?
No, not cheese curds. Not at all. No, we'll normally have Stouffleus, which is like a stew, a beef stew, but that's like a meal. Really good, like garlic mayonnaise or warm curry sauce or cold curry sauce or.
Curry sauce.
Yeah, the curry sauce over there is fantastic.
I actually once at the Scottish Highland Games, I had haggis on French fries. It's pretty good.
Man.
Haggis by itself is pretty nasty, but haggis and French fries, it's like I'm so happy to be eating French fries, I might as well just add some protein.